Protection to order. It's Tuesday, April 24th. Just going to give a brief little summary about what we're doing this evening. So, and I apologize for the long list of bills that are on work session, and maybe some of you have come for some bills that we're actually not even going to be talking about tonight. So tonight we are going to be talking about House Bill 2002, House Bill 3077, and House Bill 3321. And that's it. And the other bills will be, that are on, all of the bills will be carried over until tomorrow. They'll, not until tomorrow, but they'll be carried over to Wednesday's meeting. And those are House Bill 2621 will be carried over. House Bill 3186 will be carried over. House Bill 3081 will be carried over. House Bill 2002, House Bill 3107, House Bill 3284, House Bill 3077, House Bill 3321 will all be carried over to Wednesday. And again, tonight we're just going to be talking about 2002, 3077, and 3321. And we're not going to be moving any of those bills tonight either. We're here to go over the amendments, to briefly go over the bills, and trying to take care of some conversation. So I appreciate and apologize for any of those of you that made an effort to get here for those other bills. With that, the committee is going to stand at ease for a few minutes while we await Joel Aereo with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Being the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
I love that.
And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2002. I'd like to call up Joel Aereo and Ed Niebert. Gentlemen, I appreciate your willingness to be here at this hour to take care of a little conversation so we won't have to do it tomorrow. So I do appreciate that. And I'm hoping you can... I know you've been working on amendments to House Bill 2002, and unfortunately I don't think we have those for us, but I still want to have a conversation about the bill and about what those amendments conceptually are going to do to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Joel Aereo, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Before we start, I want to just warn you that Ed and I used to be in a carpool, and when we were in the carpool, people would say at the beginning of the ride home, will you guys please start talking about actuarial stuff because we all need to go to sleep, and it usually worked. So we'll try not to put you guys to sleep today. We did file amendments, and you don't have those in front of you, but what you do have is talking. Do they have the talking points?
No, actually, they don't.
Well, Ed, do we have enough copies?
No, I got a few copies.
We'll give you a few copies because what the insurers have done is put together a set of talking points on their response to our proposed amendment. So I think the probably the best order here is for Ed to summarize what they now support, and then I can talk about where we still have a couple of differences with them.
Chair Holden, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan, and I've been sort of the lead liaison for the health insurance industry in looking at HB 2002, working with the division to try to come to a consensus between the two of us, let me put it, on making this revision of market reforms work in Oregon. Joel is correct that the talking points that are being handed out reflect the current consensus of the insurance industry, but I want to add we have been in conversation with Joel's office, and I think we've got close call consensus. I'll leave it to Joel to talk about some issues where he may have some questions. But this isn't we've been in one room, he's been in another, and he's never seen it, and we hope he likes it. We have been talking, and we think we're pretty close. So let me go over these quickly. I just want to remind everyone for context, what we're talking about here is melding together two sections of the health insurance market for groups, the section that covers small employers of up to 25 employees, which is the bigger section, about 193,000 workers covered in that market, and melding it with the next market segment that goes up to 50 employees, which covers about 71,000 employees. So it would make that market quite a bit bigger, and the hope is more stable for the entirety. So the proposal is, our proposal is to expand that small group market from 2 to 25 up to 2 to 50. We would propose to do that by determining group size by counting total employees. Today we count group size by counting eligible employees, and it gets a little technical, and I won't bore you with that. But under federal legislation also that carries the designation HIPAA, they say determine a small employer of up to 50 by counting total employees. We would propose to do it that way to keep it simple and keep it consistent with federal regulations. We would, though, propose that if an employer has 51 or more employees and therefore would be considered a large employer and not subject to the guaranteed issue requirements of a small employer, that they would have a choice. If they're a large employer, they can ask the carrier, treat me as a large employer, and see if we can come up with a policy that covers all my employees. But if they have less than 50 eligible employees, employees that work full-time, aren't seasonal, aren't temporary, that sort of thing. If they have less than 50 eligible employees, the proposal would be that they could ask for a policy just to cover their eligible employees, like today, and that would be a small employer group policy. So we think that this works for employers and works for insurers by giving sort of a dual choice. We would propose taking today's rate bands. You may remember prior testimony. This is the constraints around how far rates can spread from the best rated group or the lowest rated group, I'll call it, to the highest rated group. There currently is a rate band of 2.5 to 1. We would propose taking that to 3 to 1 because today's market for the 26 to 50 groups has no rate band, and so this would be a compromise between the existing rate band and the current market for those groups. We would also propose adding more flexible rating within the band. This, again, will sound familiar to prior testimony. Just quickly, those factors would be taking into account the age, not just of employees like today, but the age of dependents. We think that's more accurate, and it encourages family participation. We would also allow taking into account the employer contribution rate, how much the employer pays toward coverage, the employee participation rate, how many employees elect to sign up, tobacco use, participation in wellness programs, and longevity with a carrier by the group. So these would be factors that you could use within the rate band to say, where should this group be placed? Today, the predominant factor that can be applied is just age and just employee age. So we think this mix of factors comes up with a more accurate and reflective placement within the rate band. Then another a key change from my last appearance before the committee would be to add one more rate factor, but in a very important and limited and what I call cushioned way. We would propose allowing a rate factor for expected claims, but in a cushioned way that would be limited to taking the rate that is determined under the standard factors that I just mentioned, and then applying an expected claims factor that could be no more than a 5% adjustment up or down. A 5% adjustment is pretty small within a rate band that has a spread of 3-1. So we're not talking about an adjustment that would carry somebody from the bottom of the rate band to the top or vice versa. But it would refine and calibrate their placement by limited to 5% a year. And our proposal would say that if a group got toward the edge of the rate band through their normal factors, and this 5% adjustment should carry them outside the rate band, above or below, that would be permissible, because, again, it would be limited to this 5% a year. And this, again, is a melding factor to take into account that today's market for 26 to 50 size employers has no rate band, and we're trying to meld together the practices of the current small market and the practices of the mid-size market. And just to close, we would propose that we phase in these changes over a 3-year period, so that we minimize market disruption, but that we start that process and we move toward it in a gradual way. And you will recall in the original version of 2002, there is a section in there that authorizes DCBS to consider profitability and investment earnings. We are proposing a little bit of clarifying language to say that that consideration of profitability and investment earnings when reviewing rates must be done in a manner that is reasonable and uniform and that applies to the rate period, the period going forward for which the rates have been filed. And Joel may have some comments on that point. I'd be glad to answer questions now or wait until after Joel. Thank you.
Go ahead, Joel.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We agree with most of what's said there. Much of it is in our original proposed amendment, so the expansion to 50, the group counting issue, we're in accord on that. We did propose 2.5-1, but if we get a total package here, we would agree to the 3-1, but only as part of the total package. The factors that are allowed, the more flexible rating factors that Ed listed, were part of our original proposal, and so we support those. And I would point out that most of those go to encouraging broader coverage. They're incentives for employers to contribute more, get more employees participating, get into wellness programs. All those things are good things in the marketplace, so these are factors that we think not only do they add more flexibility, but they're also encouraging the right kind of behavior in the market. So we're in accord there, and then we're also in accord with the phase-in over 3 years, and the proposed language from the insurers has that be something that we would work on through rulemaking, because there are a lot of issues to make sure that the carriers are all doing it the same way and not gaming against each other and so forth. So all of that is what we agree on. The two points that we still have some questions on, and we don't fundamentally disagree on these points, but we have some still questions on, are the use of expected claims. We're fine with that basically in the 26 to 50 part of the market, where again there hasn't been any limitation on that to today, so allowing that to continue to be used in the limited way that Ed said we think is appropriate. We have difficulty with using that in the 2 to 25 market for a couple reasons. One, if you think about that market in terms of the rest of the bill, if we don't get a bill, if we don't have any consensus, then that market goes back towards community rating. It goes back to a 2-1 rate band. So the rate band here is already going to be expanded 50% from what would otherwise be under this bill. And then all of these more flexible factors are also new things in that market. So for that part of the market, unlike the 26 to 50, we've already in this proposal agreed to create a lot more flexibility and a wider rate band. So that's factor one that concerns us about. On top of that, adding another new factor in that part of the market, expected claims experience. And then the second reason is that although claims experience is actuarially valid in all parts of the market, any actuary would tell you that when you're using the claims experience of a large group of people, it is more predictive than when you're trying to use the claims experience of a smaller group of people. And then it's also, in some kind of fundamental public policy sense, I think less fair in the sense that one of the reasons why the large group market, which has, you know, is based totally on claims experience, basically, that's how rates are set, is the aggregate claims experience. That works because you get up to 100, 200, 300 people, and the claims experience is pretty predictable for the group. There are going to be some people sick, some people, most people not, and it all balances out. In a small group, particularly, say, a group of two or three or five people, one person having serious claims issues in a year will dramatically impact the predicted claims experience of that group for the next year. So it does have, it's much more volatile use of claims experience in the 2 to 25 market. So we would prefer still, and this is still under discussion, that the claims experience issue be for the 26 to 50 market, not for the 2 to 25. And you can imagine all the calibrations that we're talking about between those. Maybe it's used a little bit, but less than what's proposed here. It has to be within the rate band or whatever. That's still what we have under discussion. So that's one issue that we still got to work out. And the second is on the profitability issue. We're fine, obviously, with the word reasonable. We're always reasonable about what we do. The word uniform still gives us some difficulty because it suggests a kind of a mathematical type of approach to this, and we don't intend to have that kind of mathematical approach of showing that, you know, how we use profitability in this case has to be mathematically correlated with how we use it in the next case. It may be a word like non-arbitrary, which I've not tried out on the ad or the other insurers yet, but that's something reasonable and not arbitrary, because we should never be arbitrary, but that gets us more into, you know, you're doing it on a case-by-case basis, and it has to be consistent and reasonable, but uniform just to us feels still a little too straitjacketed. So that issue, those are the two issues that we still have under discussion. But if you think about where we started this whole process, you know, I do think we're giving you a progress report that says we're getting awfully close here, and probably can put this together before your deadlines next Monday. Be happy to answer questions as well.
Questions, Representative Galizio.
Well, one observation, I don't think non-arbitrary would pass the Riley clear language test.
That's right.
So I can consistent, okay. Could you talk about a little bit about, so you're talking about the possibility of a hybrid model? In other words, when you were saying that, mm-hmm. in terms of the, you know, actuarial, you know, in terms of the expected claims, you're, it sounds like you were, Joel, you were describing some kind of a hybrid. And so Maybe
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, let me start, and then Ed can comment. We do want one pool from 2 to 50, so it's important that the proposal on expected claims isn't affect where somebody gets in the rate band to start with. So everybody would start with the same kind of put themselves somewhere in the rate band based on all of these factors. And then the question is, can you, in essence, give a surcharge or a credit to somebody, and so the surcharges and credits, we think, can operate differently in different parts of the market without affecting the fact that it's still one pool. So that's sort of the concept of, should the credits and surcharges be allowed with these smaller groups where they're more subject to volatility in claims experience?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a couple of comments. On that, I think Joel has laid out those issues well. It's true that claim experience consideration today does apply in the 26 to 50 market, because today that market is not regulated for rates at all. And so we would certainly say that it makes sense there to achieve some continuity of rating for that group. But we would also say that it makes sense in this very cushioned, limited way, 5% a year. It also makes sense in the smaller size groups, because to the extent that we're using actual, valid, predictive claims experience, we're not talking about using, last year a member of a three-person group fell downstairs and that drove up their claims, and so suddenly we're going to rate them higher forever after. We'd be looking for predictive claims experience factors such as chronic disease. And a chronic disease is as valid for an employee in a large group as it is for an employee in a small group. And without boring you with the kind of stuff that put our carpool mates to sleep, It is very true that in the smallest end of the market, what we sometimes call the 2Z, 3Z, 4Z size groups, they have much more discretion about when they buy insurance as a small group and stop buying it, and for whom they buy it in their small, perhaps family business. And they have some discretion to create what's called in the trade anti-selection, sort of timed enrollment in insurance to say, oh, Charlie just got a bad diagnosis. We better get Charlie covered. And to the extent that that happens at the smallest end of the market, we think this cushioned recognition of valid predictive claims to refine their rate is as valid for them as it is for the larger groups. That's why we have it in our proposal.
Again, Mr. Chair, we don't dispute that it's valid from an actuarial perspective. The issue more for us is this public policy issue. Is it a fair thing to do because the purpose of the small group laws in the first place is pooling, and so that the smallest end isn't subject to their own experience very much. That's the issue.
And Mr. Chair, if I can jump back in, and validity, we're not after validity in some statistical, philosophical, for some statistical, philosophical motive. We're after validity because the trick to a regulated market that has guaranteed issue of coverages, the trick is to blend rate fairness with also recognition of the cost of coverage so that you encourage lower cost groups that may be younger, healthier, you encourage them to come in the market and stay in the market. Because if they leave the market, everyone else pays more. And so we're after this not out of some sense of, oh, it ought to be. We're after it because we think it would have a positive impact in balancing the market.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm nearly overcome with sleepiness. But I remembered what I wanted to ask you, which is phase-in changes over 3 years on this outline. How does that compare with the original bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, that's what we had in our proposed amendments. But actually, if you go back to the original bill, we had a concept of no more than a 10% rate increase in any given year. And in the discussions, we think that's a little bit arbitrary kind of guideline for this, and that trying to work this out in a broader sense that takes into account all of the different factors, it makes more sense.
So, follow up,
please.
So there's a consensus that that is a reasonable, quote, phase-in. 3 years is enough.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes, that at this point is a consensus position.
Thank you.
Questions? So I'm curious about, you mentioned you might have an agreement by the time this committee is ready for it, I suppose, or before we adjourn. What we currently have a request for drafting in right now. So in that particular request, and maybe you've already addressed this with the expected claims, but what specific pieces are under disagreement that's in the current request for drafting?
Mr. Chair, the expected claims is not in the amendments are in for drafting right now, but we do have precise language on that issue once we agree on who it's going to apply to. And then on the profitability, the insurer's additional language about reasonable and uniform, and it's got some other language beyond that too, that's even more technical. We haven't agreed on that, but it's just a matter of a few words. So in terms of the mechanics of this, really the only issues that need more drafting of any consequence are the expected claims and the profitability. And on both of those issues, if we get to an agreement, we will have pretty precise language to offer to legislative counsel.
So to follow up, that request hasn't been made for that language because you haven't agreed upon it yet?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And to follow up on my question, when do you think you'll agree to it?
Mr. Chair, I believe we're quite close. I mean, I tried to describe as best I could the couple issues left. And,
well, I was considering, you know, giving us a couple options, and, you know.
Mr. Chair, I can't agree to it. It's
not in my interest, really, to wait till, I mean, we can wait till Monday, but I'd prefer not to have to do that, but...
Mr. Chair, I believe that, as always the case, is entirely within your control. You could say, come back here at a certain point, and whatever you haven't agreed on, give us your best offer, and they can give their best offer, and then the committee can decide. We can take that approach to it as well.
Yeah. I'm not directing you to do that. I was just exploring the thought. another question... You know, in this proposal, you know, and I like the idea about counting the total employees and, you know, then having the flexibility to select a large group contract in certain situations or a small group contract. Can you tell me what would motivate an employer to choose to be in the large group contract or to choose to be in the small group contract?
Mr. Chair, I can give you an illustration. Today what can happen, let's just take a hypothetical employer of 100 total employees, but a sizable fraction of them are temporary or seasonal employees. I've heard one of my carrier colleagues talk about a business that deals with skiing up on the mountain. Gee, they've got some year-round employees, and then they've got a bunch of seasonal employees. Under today's rule, we have to count just their eligible employees. So they could have 100 total and 20 eligible. And we say, sure, we'll give you a policy for your 20 eligibles. And maybe that's what they want, and if that's what they want, they're happy. But maybe they want a policy for all 100 or 80 of the 100. And we tell them today's rules don't let us do that. You're defying your pigeonholed. So if they want to cover the fuller group with the more flexibility that's available to a large group, we'll say fine, because that is actually your starting definition. But if you want to cover your subgroup of eligibles, we'll treat you as a smaller subgroup.
Any comments?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with what Ned just said.
Okay. Representative Riley.
This probably came out sometime. Tell me what eligible means. You keep talking about eligible and...
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, today eligible means an employee that works on a regularly scheduled basis of at least 17 and a half hours per week, but it the employer can require more than 17 and a half. They can't require us to accept less than 17 and a half. But eligible never includes temporary or seasonal employees or part-time below 17 and a half. So that's where people can get pigeonholed.
Thank you.
So just follow up and make sure I'm clear about that. So a temporary or seasonal employee is not an eligible employee?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. By definition, they're not an eligible employee.
And I assume we have definitions of what seasonal and temporary are?
Mr. Chair, I don't think the statute or the rules define that further, but I don't think we've had problems in a practical way agreeing when a group comes to us what a temporary or seasonal employee has been.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we're eligible.
You may not be. Wait a minute. Lost my train of thought now. Way to go. So are there any other questions?
Exactly.
Of these proposed amendments? So, Mr. Ariel, I guess I'll ask one more. So do you think if this bill comes together and there's an agreement on, you know, we've got a consensus almost and we're still struggling with a couple little pieces, but, you know, hypothetically, if we're almost okay with this bill and it goes forward with one of these options of the including or not of the expected claims and the reasonable profitability and all that sort of stuff, do you think that this bill is going to provide DCBS enough vision or oversight of the industry to accomplish the goals of this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do. I believe that you know, having worked on this stuff for the last dozen years, I think we did the last major reforms in 1995, and those have stood, I believe, the test of time, and we've had a pretty good market. But I do think we're now at a point where we do need to do something with our market, both in the sense of expanding it to make a bigger pool and a more stable pool, and secondly, to allow a little more flexibility into that market, particularly since part of what we're bringing together had a lot more flexibility up until the point of this bill. So I do think this properly does bigger, more stable pool, more flexibility, but yet flexibility within a range that will keep insurance affordable for the people who are most in need of that insurance, and that is the people who don't have, who aren't in good health. And so I think that's what we're trying to balance out here. And I believe this bill, along the lines that we're talking about, will be a good bill for the marketplace, and will work for us.
Thank you. And Mr. Niebert, do you think this same proposal is something the insurance industry can accommodate and still not have it drastically negatively impact your industry and its ability to provide coverage to employers?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. I would say the industry has had pretty strong philosophical support with the idea of a merged market and the potential to add stability, as long as, again, that there was a fair melding of the factors. And we think our proposal and what we think we're hearing Joel talk about can lead to that. So, yes, I think we feel that Oregon can continue its success of having a strong, protective, and stable small group market.
Thank you. Any other questions or thoughts from the committee? Well, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2002. And before you get up, I'm going to open a work session on that other bill.
3077.
Let's do 3321. Have you gentlemen had the opportunity to look at the amendments to that bill?
Mr. Chair, I have. I'm not sure about Ed.
I have, Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. I was hoping you had. So, Joel, I was wondering if you could just give us a little, since you've looked at those amendments, if you could give this committee sort of an overlook of what those amendments do.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. Let me, though, preface my comments, because a lot of people have asked this question of us, do we support this bill, do we oppose this bill? We don't have a position on the bill to speak. It was not part of the recommendations that we put forward in our report. But I can describe what the bill does and how it relates to that report.
And I recognize that this bill wasn't something that came from your agency or from Mr. Niebers, but I'm asking this because I'd like to hear your thoughts from actually both of you gentlemen on this proposal.
Mr. Chair, again, with no position, what I can do, I think, most effectively is simply describe what is in the bill and then answer questions. And I'm going to use the same format that my boss, Corey Streisinger, used when she first spoke to the committee about House Bill 3077, which was, you'll remember, the broader rate review bill, and said there were essentially four questions to answer about any proposal having to do with rate review. One of them is what kind of insurance is regulated. Two is what standards should be applied to the review of how should we regulate that particular type of insurance. Third question is what process is there that attaches to that review, what kind of public involvement, and the fourth question is who's responsible for the review. And applying those four questions to the amendments that I'm talking now, to the Dash 2 amendments, I believe is what you'd like me to talk to, which insurance is regulated, this bill would add to what we currently regulate. Currently we regulate the individual portability in small employer markets. This bill would add large employer insurance to what we would regulate under limited conditions. If you look to Section 3 of the amendments, for the parts of the market, the large employer parts of the market that we don't currently regulate, they would be regulated if one of the following people requested us, or one of the following entities requested review: the employer, the 25% of the enrollees or prospective enrollees, or a union representing employees who are enrollees or prospective enrollees. So the regulation of the large group market would be sort of upon request, if you will. So that would be the new, add be the answer to the question of what does this bill change in terms of who is regulated. The second question, what standards should be applied? There are several new standards in this bill, and they're found in Section 5 of the Dash 2 amendment. The first new language, and I'm not giving you every detail in the bill, but the high points, is in Section 5, Sub 2. The language is that the insurer has the burden of proving that the rate is reasonable and justified. That's new language to what we currently use. The idea that the insurer has the burden, that is true. That's always been true. The insurer has to defend their proposals to us under a prior approval system. The second new language, and this is probably the most significant new language, is in Sub 3, that the director would approve the filing if the director determines that the health benefit plan provides for, quote, appropriate accessibility and affordability of needed health care services. And then it adds, again, the proposed rates are reasonable and justified. So that new standard of approving it for it provides for appropriate accessibility and affordability of needed health care services is a new standard for us to apply. And then third, another new standard appears in sub, again, we're still in Section 5, but Sub 4, Sub B, the rates could be disapproved if they were, quote, unfair or excessive. That's language that is in the property and casualty side of the statutes now, but not in the health insurance statute. So you've got three different standards: reasonable and justified, appropriate accessibility and affordability, and unfair or excessive. All of those would be new terms, and presumably we'd have to figure out exactly what they meant in any given context. The third question is, what kind of process for rate review is there, and what is the public involvement? And again, here there are several changes in the bill to current practice. These are in Sections 3, 5, and 6. In Section 3, Sub 2, the bill provides that filings would be open to public inspection immediately upon submission to the department. If 3103 were to pass, the bill that was approved on the floor today, this standard wouldn't be a change. This is the same standard that's in that bill. So it's redundant with that bill, but that bill hadn't passed the whole process yet. Secondly, in 3 sub 3, there's this procedure for petitioning for large group review. That's a new opportunity for public involvement, petition to have large group rates reviewed. And then in Section 5, there's an opportunity for public comment that's not formalized in the current process, and so there's a spelled out process in Section 5 about how to make public comment, and there's language, I think, in Section 6 that says the director shall take that comment into account when deciding what to do. And then finally, in Section 6, Sub 1, there's a procedure for a public hearing. So open to inspection, petitioning for large groups, public comment opportunities, and public hearing opportunities. Those are all new forms of public involvement in the process. And then finally, who should be responsible? And you'll recall this is the issue on we tried to be as neutral as we could in how we described those questions on 3077, but if we had a tilt, it was on that question towards the direction of, surprise, surprise, we think we are staying in control of the process, primarily because we are in control of the process or are accountable on the end where somebody is in financial difficulty, and so we thought it would be difficult to have a situation where we might be saying somebody's got to raise rates because they're in financial difficulty, and there was some other entity that might be saying take rates down. This bill does keep the status quo, keeps us, the department, the director ultimately, Director Streisinger, in charge of the process. So there are significant changes on three of the four questions. On the fourth question of who should be responsible, that stays core in this bill.
Thank you. Does anybody have questions of Joel on that rendition? And Mr. Niebert, would you like to comment on this this bill or this proposed amendment to this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would. Thank you for the opportunity. I respect and understand Mr. Aereo's tactful expression of neutrality on this bill. We have a much less tactful position of opposition, and it's not because, we as insurers don't think that rate review has any place with health insurance. We just finished 5 minutes ago talking about expanded rate regulation for the small for an expanded small group market. This bill proposes to bring rate regulation in a very strange and upon request, I'll call it somewhat hit or miss process into the large group market, which has never been regulated in this state. And why? Because large groups and insurers are both armed with knowledge about negotiating rates. Large groups every day bring well-informed and well-paid consultants and brokers to the table to negotiate with us based upon their experience of what's happening in the market with other clients and other insurers, and making darn sure that we have a sharp pencil when it comes to rating. And they're not only bringing to the table their knowledge of the competitive insurance environment, but they're bringing to the table their knowledge of their option to abandon the insurance market and become self-funded, self-insured, where they don't have to talk to us as an insurer, and certainly they don't have to talk to the insurance department because they're no longer insured. And we believe there simply is no evidence that, I guess we could go back to the start of the state, but let's go back to the insurance code in 1967. When the insurance code was last revised in 1967, there was no regulation of large group health insurance rates. There has been no sign of market failure regarding large group health insurance rates. And this seems to assume that there is some failure. It seems to me that that assumption is wrong, that these procedures would be slow, costly, and burdensome to us as insurers and to the division, and it seems to me that it's a solution in search of a problem. So that perhaps was not tactful, but that is our view.
Mr. Chair, Ed appreciates nuance. He called our position neutral. I do want to be clear. We consider a big difference between neutral and no position. Neutral sort of implies, you know, there's some good things, some bad things, and we kind of split the baby and couldn't go either way. No position is a position saying we're just not taking a position on the bill and just coming and providing information.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate that clarity. Does the committee have any questions on this? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joel, I would like, even though you take no position, I would like your take on one piece of this, and that's the idea of on request. as opposed to do it all or don't do it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, one of the reasons I just made the distinction I did was to avoid having to take a value position either way on it. But I'm going to frame this in terms of, you know, what one might argue on one side, what one might argue on the other side, rather than a position. And I think one would say that the hardest issue with the large group market is to say if they're negotiating all of their own rates and everybody seems to be satisfied, exactly where would the state weigh into that process? The upon request issue deals with that particular argument, one could say, in a forum, saying the state wouldn't get into it unless the parties asked the state to get into it. On the other side, of course, only one party has to ask in this scheme the way it's proposed.
That was pretty tactful.
Yeah, I thought so.
I'm trying to be, you know, no positioning.
I have a question for Mr. Neely. What evidence would constitute market failure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I think market failure would be evidenced by, number one, insurers leaving the market because they can't compete, or their market volume has disappeared because employers have reverted to self-insurance, or contrarily, employers abandoning insurance in large numbers for self-insurance. And I don't think we see today, nor have ever seen in the past, evidence of either of those in this market. I think we've got a well-balanced market where insured coverage is predominant. Self-insured coverage is significant at the larger end, but not predominant. And we have and continue to have strong competition, which I can say from a personal point of view, I'm thankful that our competition is anchored by local, domestic, and by, in large measure, nonprofit insurers in this state. So I think that's evidence of a healthy market.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to make an observation that I've made in another committee, I mean, Human Services, Women's Wellness. I don't know whose job it is to coordinate or monitor all the health-related issues that we've got in this session, but we've got them in this committee. And if you take each one, I don't know exactly what the effect is going to be on a rate review like this, but if it does raise rates and we pass that on to consumer, my question is, at the end of this session, if you look at 40 or 50 bills spread out over I don't know how many committees, and then you add it up, all of those things isolated, discussing them here or discussing them in the committee, are all good and interesting and compelling. But added up, we're handing a bill to folks that got to pay the bill when all of us, and I mean all my colleagues on either side, are committed to lowering health insurance costs. And so I have no conclusion other than I just needed to express that.
That was interesting. I appreciate it. Any other questions?
I guess I have one about the self-insureds, and I guess this would go to Mr. Aereo. When we're speaking of self-insureds, do we have any information or data on what size of employers or how many employees, essentially, those particular employers, how big are they, the ones that actually self-insure? Are they 75 employees? Are they 100, 500, 1,000, 10,000?
Mr. Chair, there is in our health report, and I'm looking for the chart here we have. We don't have a lot of information about self-insurance. We don't have very much information at all. In fact, we estimated in this report that the number of self-insured in the state is 666,000, or 18% of the market. But if you read the fine print, you'd see that the way we got there was we know pretty much what each of the other market segments has, and so this was the leftover of the state's population after we calculated everything else. So some people would think it might be a couple hundred thousand bigger. Some people think it may be a little smaller than that, but it's somewhere in that 18, 20, 25% range. If you talk to the actuaries about self-insurance, they would say when you get to in the private market, a group of 250 or more self-insurance starts to become a reasonable kind of prospect at about that number. Below that, you are dealing with there's a lot more risk. That kind of volatility issue that what I talked about with the groups of two, it's extremely volatile, but even groups of 50 or 100, it's more volatile than at 250, pretty predictable. So you can self-insure for that reason. And then the second issue with self-insurance is you do have to have more wherewithal. You're paying people to do administrative things, you got to have actuaries and that sort of thing involved, so there's some cost to all of that. So my actuaries are telling me around 250 in the commercial market is where self-insurance becomes feasible. The one thing that can move that down a little bit is there's all kinds of, I would say in some respects, gimmicks almost, but there are ways to say that you're self-insured, but then buy other kinds of insurance on the side that actually are covering a lot of your risk. So if you start thinking that people can buy certain types of stop-loss coverage, then there are people who tell you that you can get that number down quite a bit lower by using some form of stop-loss, which is kind of reinsurance. But true self-insurance, where you're actually bearing your own risks, is probably needs at least a couple hundred lives.
So, Mr. Niebert, in your previous statement, you had mentioned that recognizing a market failure in the large employer plan would be to see large employers moving to self-insurance, but our definition of large employer is 50 and above, so there's this space between 50 and 250 or so where you really wouldn't see that as I'm guessing, and correct me if my assumptions are wrong because they could be, but you really wouldn't see that as a market failure in that range of employees, you know, between 50 and say 250, where you really wouldn't see self-insurers come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's a fair generalization. I think Joel's described it well. Just a quick side note here. My first job in Oregon was running a self-insured health benefit plan for a long-time Oregon employer, Hyster Company, founded in Oregon 60-some years ago. My next job was running a self-funded benefit plan for Tektronix. The rule of thumb in the late 70s, 80s, into the, I'd say, early 90s is, 1,000 employees for self-insurance gives you a pretty stable pool. And the number would inch down, and then the standard sort of became, maybe 500. Joel has talked about maybe 250. What we would see as market failure is not that another jumbo employer of 1,000 or 2,000 would switch from insurance to self-insurance. That sort of stuff's been happening for a long time. But what we would see is that number getting pushed down. We'd see more in that range of 250 and maybe 200 or 100 pushing their luck in the self-insurance market. Because self-insurance means just that. You make a promise of benefit coverage, and you hold your breath and hold your checkbook, and you write the benefit checks when the claims show up. And yes, you go out and buy stop-loss reinsurance coverage, but of course all you're doing is buying insurance on top of self-insurance, and those folks aren't selling that for free. So you're going to pay for your losses, and you're going to hope that you can afford your losses.
Thank you. That clarified my question in my mind. Any other questions? Let me see. The committee looks pretty sleepy at this point, so I thank you for that, and I'm going to excuse you from the desk there. And I want to give I don't know if Laura Etherton, if you want to talk to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Hope I didn't catch you off guard any, but I thought you might have some thoughts on this.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. Thank you for the opportunity to say a few words about House Bill 3321-2. OSPIRG supports this bill with the Dash 2 amendments. Oregonians, ranging from consumers, taxpayers, large employers, small employers, are all feeling the squeeze from rising health insurance rates. It's a problem that is hard to escape. This bill, I think, can be seen sort of as complementing the larger discussions that Representative Gilliam mentioned, very large discussions happening all around this building about health reform and how to reduce the costs that people are bearing for health insurance and for the health care itself. I won't rehash what the bill does too much, but basically, as Joel mentioned, it does keep, as is currently the process, the rate review process within DCBS, which we think makes sense as opposed to layering another board on top of that at this point, though that might be an option that the legislature would want to look to in the future. And it adds some important standards for affordability, accessibility, and some standards that say that insurance rates shouldn't be excessive or unreasonable, and those standards seem appropriate. It also adds additional information for DCBS to consider while making those determinations. From the financial and the...
Make sure you turn off your cell
phone. The plans. Yeah, mine's off, too. Make sure. Oh, yeah, excellent. And also opens the process up more to public involvement, which is appropriate not only for the public to be able to view the insurance filings, but be able to actually participate in a meaningful way through public comments, and if DCBS deems it appropriate, to actually open up to a public hearing if that isn't necessary. Finally, I wanted to add that the bill also looks toward the very cost containment goals, I think, that many of the discussions in the legislature now around health care reform are revolving around, and asks for insurers, as part of their rate filings, to list cost containment measures that they're engaging in to help to reduce the cost of health care while maintaining or even improving health care outcomes. So, again, the goal, I think, here with the bill is certainly to add some additional accountability and to help reduce the costs of health insurance for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I appreciate you coming forward and giving us your point of view on this. Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 3321 and open our work session on House Bill 3077. Mr. Ario, would you like to come up and give us another rendition of yet another insurance bill with the proposed amendments to this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Joel Ario, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Same position as last time, i.e. no position, not one of our recommendations, but I am here to describe what the bill does. And this one's pretty simple. It's several pages long because of the rule that you got to copy the whole section that you're amending. But the only change in the dash ones, if you look at it, And this, remember, was a massive bill that had a PUC-style rate review procedure originally, is now a bill that applies specifically to the general standard of when a rate is excessive in the property and casualty marketplace. And under current law, the if you look at lines 11, basically look at line 11 in the bill, the current law is that no rate shall be excessive unless it is both unreasonably high and there is not a reasonable degree of competition. This changes the and to an or, which means that a rate could be found excessive if either it was unreasonably high or there was not a competitive market. So it would create more flexibility, more authority to find a rate excessive. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
I have a problem with the second part of that. I mean, I understand the bill with an and in it. I understand the first half of that or, but the second half of that or, if there's, you can find it excessive if there's no competition. I don't get that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, you correctly state what the bill says. I don't know that I can explain it better. I will tell you that I did ask my actuary that question, and she said that she thought she could imagine a circumstance in which, simply because it was a non-competitive market, a rate would be found excessive, even if it wasn't unreasonably high. But I did not understand the explanation, and so I certainly can't explain it to you.
Thank you. If you didn't understand it, I feel better.
Mr. Arroyo, so this amendment, as you see it, eliminates establishing an insurance rate review board. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. I believe it deletes the entire bill. Maybe I didn't read it carefully enough, but I think that's what it does. Is that, looking to your able
right.
counsel there, and he's nodding, so I do think that's what it actually does.
So, and can you tell me what classes of insurance this bill would apply to? I mean, would this affect health insurance, this bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe not. I was told in the hall that there is an argument that it does. I understood that it applied just to property and casualty insurance, and you remember from our presentation that's quite a long list of products, and some of them wouldn't be as affected by this because they're already prior approval or otherwise more heavily regulated. I think the main thrust of this bill would be in the marketplaces that are currently filed in use, particularly the auto and homeowner markets, and the weight of the bill would fall not on the second part of the bill where the finding would be excessive because there's not competition, because those markets do have competition. It would be the first part of the bill that even in those competitive markets there could be a finding that a rate was unreasonably high. I think that's the primary thrust of what the bill would do, as I understand it. Today, in those competitive markets, it's not possible for us to find a rate unreasonably high or excessive.
Thank you. Further questions, Mr. Arroyo, on this bill? You're off the hook.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming in and briefing us on these three bills. It's helpful to me, at least, and I think to some of my other committee members, and understanding what we're looking at with all three of these bills at once. So I appreciate your spending a little time with us this evening.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know, Mr. Powell, do you care to comment on this particular bill?
He's neutral on that.
He's going to be, I'm taxed for too, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we haven't had much time to review this. However, we did get back some comments which had questions similar to those that Representative Riley raised. I think this is standard language, the existing language, not the amended language. I think it is pretty standard across the country. And if you look at the lines of insurance that Mr. Ariel pointed to as being the primary targets of this statute, Oregon is 49th out of 50 in terms of the lowest homeowners rates, and we're in the bottom half of the states in terms of auto rates. So we wouldn't see a problem that this would resolve. So we're still gathering more information on it. That's all I had to say.
And perhaps a question that maybe I should have asked Mr. Ariel too. This bill, I guess, looks like it deals with property and casualty and not health insurance per se. Do you see that this would have any bearing on perhaps liability insurance for, say, some other industries like the construction industry, for example?
Mr. Chairman, it possibly would relate to that. But again, I was one of those talking to Mr. Ayo out in the hall trying to figure out what it did apply to, and we just haven't had time to look at it.
Okay.
It's possible it could.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Powell?
I appreciate you coming forward and apologize for you not having a lot of time to look at this, but maybe if you look at it some more and want to talk to me some more about it, I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else that would like to comment on House Bill 3077? I know we're in work session, not in public hearing, but I am inviting anybody else would like to comment on that, not having reviewed it. Okay, well, I appreciate you spending some quality time with us this evening. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3077 and adjourn the Committee on Consumer Protection.